people. You think about the persons that come in and spray your house for termites, structural pest control. That's a very active commission. And they are a sovereign commission, whereas advisory commission on pesticide is advisory in nature. Structural pest control is a sovereign commission. And so, you know, they're housed within the agency, but they oversee the pest control. Sweet Potato Advertising and Development Commission, again, oversee, you know, the funding that is provided by the farmers for sweet potatoes. And most of that goes to the Chase Research Station, which is the preeminent sweet potato research station in the United States. So agriculture, agro-consumer services, you think, so what you see here is a gentleman, he's putting the fuel back into the tanks, but where we test the gas stations, you see these units that are there where we're checking fuel stations for, one, to make sure a gallon is a gallon, that gasoline is gasoline, that it meets national standards, that unleaded and high octane are exactly that, they meet those standards. We check for water in the fuel, we check for gas in the diesel, and vice versa. So, again, that is a very active commission. Kevin Finley's assistant commissioner, along with a number of other members. And so when you look at what we do there is that we oversee the marketplace. So you think about weights, you think about scales. Everything that is bought and sold, the Office of Metrology, weights, measures, and standards. So if you buy a quart of oil, it's got to be a quart, and it's got to be oil that meets national standards. And so we test all the different parameters for whatever that particular commodity is. And so whether it is a sack of oysters, or it is a pound of frozen shrimp, or it is, you know, a 50-pound bag of seed or whatever it is, or if it's the amount of candy in a candy bar. Right? All of those things fall under that. And so we have the Ag Commodities Commission, where we oversee the grain elevators and the brokers, and we're going to have bills, some legislation dealing with that. We did have the failure this year of Hanson Mueller, a large brokerage firm that was doing business in this state, and by which we had to utilize money from the Grain and Cotton Indemnity Fund. The Dairy Stabilization Board, which maintains stability in the marketplace dealing with dairy goods, and it's very important, especially at the retail level, more in your grocery stores, right, to have stability in that marketplace. And basically what it does, it says you can't sell products below cost. You can't sell any commodity below cost, but there's a special emphasis watching dairy because the potential for abuse there has always been much higher than in the other commodities. The Weights and Measures Commission, and again, they're very busy, so everything from scanners to the scales to what's in the different commodities, and that is a very active commission. And now the Seafood Safety Task Force and our seafood, all the things with labels and testing, that all falls now within the Weights and Measures Commission. Office of Animal Health and Food Safety. And so, again, as we are now watching for the New World screwworm, which we're watching very closely, or any particular diseases that could affect, you know, livestock, poultry, and also dealing with food safety. So the Office of the State Veterinarian and the Board of Animal Health is there. Egg Commission is there. The Livestock Brand Division is there. Food Distribution, headed by Mac Williams. So we handle food distribution for the USDA that goes to schools, prisons. It also goes into food banks. We administer programs, federal programs and others, dealing with the food banks and the schools. And then we have the Animal Feed Division. All animal feeds must be manufactured and must, whatever sold, have to meet the Federal Veterinary Feed Directive. There's a specific laws by the federal government for animal feed, because animal feed, those animals consume that and it becomes human food. So, again, under food safety. And so, again, guard and protect the integrity of the livestock industry. And we work, that's a very active part. And, of course, we work, again, with the veterinary school, through the diagnostic lab, and all the other entities, protecting the food chain. And that is a big deal, protecting the food chain, controlling livestock theft, and denying a market for stolen livestock and farm equipment, administer USDA commodity programs, coordinate the emergency management and response. So one of the things, we are ESF 11. So emergency management response, we deal with fire, as you quite well know, as well as logistics, food distribution, and we work coordinated with GOSEP. We have a seat at GOSEP, and as we've been there many years. And regulation of animal feeds according to the federal guidelines, which are very, very, very specific to follow that. So animal feed, emergency management, food distribution, food quality, livestock brand, meat and poultry inspection program. So, you know, we inspect a total of about 50, 60 meat plants and through our inspectors, and these are the state inspectors. Poultry and egg, and we do egg inspections, and veterinary health division, the Board of Veterinary Medicine is housed there. Boards and commissions in animal health. Louisiana Animal Control Advisory Task Force. We advise the government entities on animal control. We do inspection of the government animal control facilities. We work with them on a continual basis. Louisiana Beef Industry Council that administers federal dollars from a federal beef checkoff. The Board of Animal Health and Food Safety. And that particular board also, under Board of Animal Health, regulates the livestock markets and the auctions. Crawfish Promotion and Research, Egg Commission, Equine Research and Promotion Board, Louisiana Livestock Brand Commission, and the Strawberry Marketing Board. Office of Forestry. And we have about 18.6 million acres of timber, 15 million acres of farm timber. It's our largest plant-based commodity. Wade Dubé is the state forester and assistant commissioner. And then Ms. Ebony Brash's associate, Matt Polk, is the protection fire chief. And of course, the management chief is Tyler Bridges. So we've been very busy in the Office of Forestry. We've had a record number of fires since really February. In the week of February 20th, on that Sunday, we had 34 fires within about 30 minutes. Sunday afternoon. Winds were high, and they got started, and as I was speaking with the chairman a few moments ago, in the state of Nebraska, they currently have 700,000 acres that just burned, 600,000 acres in one big fire. Our largest fire ever was 53,000 acres in 2003. That would be in August, and that was the Tiger Island fire. So what's happening now, post-freeze, the grass is dry. We had winds 35 to 40 miles an hour. And the vast majority were arson cases. And so, again, we're very aggressive on prosecuting arson and also asking for full restitution for that. The fire in St. Tammany Parish was over 400 acres, and it started at 4 o'clock. We had aircraft in the air that saw the ignition, and we had personnel on it, you know, immediately. And, of course, it jumped the interstate. So you think about it, jumped the interstate. That's how those 35 and 45 mile an hour gusts of wind. So forest protection, again, against diseases, forest management. And so we also work with the state forest and then, of course, the Alexander State Forest and private landowners on forest management, forest health, enforcement, and aviation. We have 12 aircraft, and those, when the weather conditions are where there can be a fire, they're in the air, they're flying grids, they're looking for smoke, and then as soon as they see one, then they rapidly diagnose, you know, what it is, if it is a wildfire, and call in our agents to come in and put that fire out, and then they stay in the air coordinating from the air on the ground with our personnel on the ground, because it's very important. You know, if you have structural firefighters, the majority of the time they're outside spraying water in, unless it's a high-rise building, of course. But our guys have to go, and girl, ladies have to go into the fire with those bulldozers. So we're trying to make sure they don't get surrounded. So sound forest management, technical assistance, insect and disease, law enforcement, fire detection, suppression, using surveillance aircraft, conservation, education, and urban forestry, associated with Louisiana Forestry Commissions, and ESF-4, wildland fire, and we're working with GOSEP. Office of Management and Finance, and again, Dane Morgan is the Assistant Commissioner, and that's where the Louisiana Agriculture Finance Authority is, Fiscal Services, Commodity Promotion and Research, Property Control, Purchasing, IT, Facility Maintenance, and Fleet Operations. And so, you know, fleet operations, facility maintenance, we have a very large fleet. I think we have about 160 to 180 units in the heavy fleet, and that's like Macs, Volvos, large trucks. Most of those carry firefighting equipment, but also pull, you know, we have tractor trailers that deliver commodities as well as heavy equipment. And then we have 400-plus what we would call passenger vehicles, which include those that are specialized, again, to, you know, carry those units to measure gasoline, et cetera. Office of Management and Finance, Fiscal Auditing, Fleet Maintenance, Human Resources, Purchasing, Property Control, Ag Finance, Commodity Promotion, Research, IT, and Risk Management. Office in Soil and Water Conservation, and that is housed within the agency, and on any given year, we administer more than $100 million of federal dollars through the Soil and Water Conservation, and we have 44 Soil and Water Conservation districts. Those are autonomous, independently set up by state law. They were set up in the 1950s, but we coordinate with them and we work with them on a, very closely. Conservation, soil and water conservation, assistance, solid waste management program, prescribed burning certification program, coastal wetland revegetation program, Clean Water Act Section 319, 9-point source pollution control, Farm Bill conservation, feral swine management assistance, and USDA watershed planning assistance. And again, it's a very big, so the State Soil and Water Conservation Commission is housed with an Office of Soil and Water there at the agency. And again, it coordinates 44 soil and water conservation districts. And we're located in Baton Rouge here. That is our main office. We have 24 facilities across the state. And with that, I'll entertain any questions.
Senator Wheat with a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner Strain. Look, I really appreciate your presentation today. I think you did a pretty good job keeping it.
You've got another one coming.
I'm impressed, by the way.
You may save that for the next.
Oh, that's the next one. Okay, I spoke too early. Sorry about that. So a couple questions, Commissioner Strain. On the last, actually, division there with the soil and water conservation.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me a little bit about the role that the Department of Agriculture plays in water quality and how you blend that with other agencies that are out there monitoring water in different capacities? So are is your jurisdiction only on water that is put on agriculture land?
No, sir.
Or is,
no,
it, is it broader than that? Tell me
so
how that
we
works.
Work hand in hand with the Department of Environmental Quality, with Coastal Conservation, with many other agencies together. To the Office of Soil and Water Conservation, our goal is to facilitate the federal programs. So, in other words, if you're doing conservation on your agricultural land, the whole goal is to minimize any runoff. So we have point source and non-point source runoff. So the goal, again, is to contain those nutrients on the land and always looking at the particular watersheds. So there's a number of different programs that we work with those conservation districts to administer with the ultimate goal of minimization of any type of runoff from agricultural land, from forestry land, and that sort of thing. So, again, the whole goal is to not have anything leaving the soil and help clean up. So everything from putting up buffer zones to absorb those nutrients to reutilization of any tailwater that comes off to developing programs that will help clean up impaired waterways, impaired watersheds. So all of that is part of that. And so what we do is that, you know, our team coordinates with the 44 soil and water conservation districts. We work with the technicians in those districts so that they can maximize the amount of dollars they draw down, which are cooperative dollars with private dollars, to utilize the, you know, the full amount of monies to maximize the environmental benefits.
So how do you monitor that, the waterways, and particularly with the runoff? Is your department depending upon DEQ to monitor and test water off of that, or do y'all have a division that actually tests to determine whether there's a leaching of those substances that you talked about into the waterways?
So we work with many different agencies in that respect. And so I can probably get you a better definitive answer on what, you know, the Office of Soil and Water does and how that is done and what that type of monitoring is. But that is a constant that is always going on. And so, you know, again, DEQ is, you know, they're mainly, you know, focusing on something that is maybe man-made in cost. You know, and our goal is to continuously monitor to decrease whatever environmental load there is. So testing may be a part of it. It depends on what that particular federal contract. So when a technician and a landowner sign up on a contract and those federal matching monies, there's parameters they have to meet according to that contract.
Okay.
And so there are, if you look at like some of the Section 19 monies that are there to facilitate impaired waterways, I'm pretty sure there would be testing to monitor what the progress is made.
I'm not sure if you've been following some of the reports that Southeastern has put forward on testing of the water bodies in the Lake Pontchartrain Basin area there, and it's pretty alarming to our citizens.
That the recent testing that's going on?
Yes.
Or is that over the, well, both the long-term testing and the recent testing. Now, you know, the recent testing is a result of the accident there at Smitty's, what's going on, and testing, you know, for hydrocarbons,
right.
You know, the volatile hydrocarbons, you know, and that sort of thing. But, you know, our focus is more on the agricultural land. If you're dealing with runoff, industrial runoff, that would be under DEQ. But we do work with them hand-in-hand with DEQ, beneficial use projects, generally any type of agricultural product. You know, if DEQ leaves that over to us, and then industrial goes over to DEQ.
Well, I think you're hitting on exactly what I'm trying to get at. Is where is that agency responsible for that, and who is doing what?
So it depends on if you're looking at an environmental issue secondary to an industrial issue, that would be EPA and DEQ predominantly.
Okay.
Right? If it's anything due to agricultural runoff, then it would be us. But again, we all work together.
Right.
So whether or not you're looking at specifically the dead zone out in the middle of the Gulf or whatever, but there's really no divide. We all work together, well, and we look at that. But again, federal government, if you look at the, especially like Section 19 impaired waterway projects, you know, there are specific projects if they identified an impaired area. And then I will give you, for instance, certain areas in the state where you cannot spread chicken litter because it would go into, quote, an impaired waterway, so that we work with those farmers so that that litter is placed somewhere else. And then we're monitoring for phosphorus and that sort of thing.
Well, you probably hit on the next question that was in my line of questioning there, and it has to do with how do we govern the ability for the allowance of human waste or spread on farmland.
Okay.
And what's happening there. I think there's been some conversations concerning about the riskiness of permanently damaging agriculture land as a result of what may be deposited in human waste, septic tanks, and that type of thing. Can you speak to that?
Yes, sir. And specifically, one of the big issues, as you know, that industrial or municipal waste, you cannot be spread on farmland. And the reason for that is PFAS and other things. And a lot of that, the first discussion, it used to be spread on farmland. And then there were some farms up on the east, around the east coast, where the PFAS was found in milk, secondary to dairy cattle grazing on land, where that type of waste had been placed for a number of years. Now, in this state, as my understanding, and we've been in discussions, you know, talking to DEQ, you cannot spread industrial, which I mean municipal waste,
right,
onto agricultural land. It must go to a landfill. However, under current law, there is no prohibition against private sewage waste doing the same thing. So I think, and I do think, there will be legislation for the prohibition of utilizing private waste, you know, from septic tanks or sewer treatment plants placed on agricultural land, specific because of the PFAS and these other forever chemical issues.
No, I think you nailed exactly where I was going with that. How do we delineate what waste is defined as what can be spread on farmland, what can't, and what is
today,
what specifically falls within the jurisdiction of the Department of Agriculture and Forestry to govern that.
All right. So that particular governance for sludge waste, we really don't look at that because, again, that has not been within our jurisdiction as far as spreading that on. And normally what would happen is I think that is regulated under DEQ or others. It would go into a sediment pond. And then from that sediment pond, it, you know, again, so if they pump out a septic tank to a treatment plant, that would be placed into a sediment pond. And then from there, either it's normally it's either decommissioned or it could be dug out, just like you would dig out a dairy pond. But just to take it and directly, I don't think you can directly spread it onto farmland. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, right? But until this point, it's never been an issue of high concern because of the amount and the volume. But now we're beginning to have a greater understanding of PFAS, and I think there's going to be a prohibition from doing that. So what would have to happen is either, one, that sludge waste, but most of this...
Define sludge waste for
okay.
me.
Okay. So you, when if you pump out a septic tank, because that's what we're talking about, or a sewer treatment plant, a home use, right? It is in a semi-liquid form. And then that would go into a oxidation pond or a series of ponds. And then at the end, when it's got to be decommissioned, there is the solids, the sludge waste. So either one, it could be covered over because these oxidation ponds have to be lined in such a way as that it can't leak into the aquifer. Okay. You know, it would have to be either decommissioned by digging it up and putting it into a landfill that is also so, you know, with a clay base, or you just cover it because it already should have a liner.
Well, I know this is going to need to be a topic for another day with
yes,
further
sir.
Discussion on this because I think that there's a lot of concerns about that in that area. So I'll leave that
yes,
for future
so,
discussion.
But my understanding, I've read and I've looked, it's in DEQ. It's okay. I'm pretty sure it's in the laws of DEQ, whether or not that is allowable.
Okay.
Beneficial use projects, if you're talking about predominantly like chicken litter and how that is handled, that generally falls under Department of Ag and under the Office of Saltwater
okay, so
Conservation.
Okay, so real quick then. So if it comes from a human waste septic tank, you're telling me DEQ regulates that?
That's my understanding,
if they're going
yes.
to put it on farmland.
That's right.
But if it comes from an agricultural product and on farmland, that's your jurisdiction?
Yes. And so, but also we work hand-in-hand with EPA. So if there's identification of an overload, or it could be from health and hospitals, and then we go in and try to work with them to figure out what the problem okay. is.
Well, let's continue that discussion. I want to move on to one other thing real quick, Mr. Chairman, if I could. The Strawberry Marketing Board, could you tell me a little bit? Obviously, Commissioner, you understand what our strawberry industry, the challenges that we're having
yes,
with
sir.
Labor like every other farming industry right now, and the competition from other sources of berries, especially the Mexican berries coming in, that's flooding our markets at times. But could you tell me about the Strawberry Marketing Board and how that operates and where the funding comes from?
And first of all, I would give them kudos. They do a great deal with very little money. Yep. And they're, you know, and it is made of market participants. So there is an assessment based on all strawberries that are sold within the state. That generates around $24,000 to $35,000 per year total. Normally what we do is we take that and we match that with specialty crop block grant monies. So we try to match it at least dollar for dollar or maybe a little bit more with specialty crop block grant monies, which is federal monies that the Strawberry Board applies for and that comes to our agency. Then on top of that, we get them a grant through the Certified Louisiana program. Those dollars come through the Agriculture Finance Authority and are based on income we generate at our industrial facilities. So we don't receive any, we receive no state monies, no state general monies for marketing, period. So we take those monies that we have pooled together, and that's what pays for the billboards, that's what pays for, you know, like the jazzy out, you know, the big strawberry outfit. For everything that we do in marketing is paid for by pooling monies. But the bottom line, self-generation is less than $50,000 a year by the board, and that's the Strawberry Marketing Board. And so, but we work with them so that, like right now, it says for, you see the billboards, ask for Louisiana strawberries. That's part of that, those billboard promotions.
Does that same principle apply to the marketing of Louisiana shrimp? Is it all self-generated there, or does the state contribute to that industry?
So for the shrimp industry, there is a certain amount of money, my understanding, that is set aside from the licenses. And that generates about $250,000 a year currently for shrimp marketing. That is within the office of the lieutenant governor. Now, the shrimp...
And so that would be considered state money there, right?
Based on an assessment on a license.
Okay.
A license assessment. But it's no state general fund,
right.
My
okay,
understanding.
Gotcha.
Now, we do work with our shrimpers, and because they are part of our certified Louisiana family, to where we can also utilize some of those certified marketing monies as we promote seafood in general. Okay. And one of the things that we will be doing this year is asking for funding that will come from gaming, and that would come from, in other words, if you bet on the Super Bowl, a certain portion of that will go into a fund that we can utilize for both testing and promotion and work with the Lieutenant Governor's office because, you know, frankly, that's a very small amount of money to, you know, to promote, you know, an industry that is on its knees.
So go back to the self-generated Strawberry Marketing Board funding, where the money's coming from. How is that assessed to the farmer?
It's not. It's assessed at the first point of sale. So it's at the first point of sale. So if
and it's based on what?
It's based on it's a certain formula. It's a very small amount, and I think it's based on volume. So much
per container,
per box, or
something.
I can look to see exactly how that fee is assessed, but it's based probably so much per pound or so much per pint. And so it's paid for, you know, like your different supermarkets or pay for it. It's at that level. So a very small amount of money.
Yeah, no, and I get that, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is there a way that can be restructured to where there's more money in the fund to help promote the strawberries that we are having out there, let people know that they need to buy Louisiana product, and how we efficiently make sure that everybody is participating mm-hmm. in that collection of those dollars fairly across the board. So I think... I'd like to dig into that a little deeper, would you?
Okay. We do monitor and audit at the first point of sale,
okay.
And we do that. And so I do believe that we have very good compliance. That program has been in effect many, many, many years.
Right.
But I will get you that mechanism of collection. Do you have it, Todd?
Yeah.
Wait, here we go. Let's see. Where's it at?
Subsection A.
Subsection A. For each pint or equivalent, in the amount of 0.00165 cents. Yeah, no, so it would be 0.165 cents per pint. And if it is by the pound, it is 0.185 per pound. So it is 0.185, so about less than 0.2 of a cent per pound, or less than 0.16 cents per pint.
And I'm trying to figure out at what point in this marketing process is it collected. So you said when it goes to, and I'm not going to name a chain or anything, but if it goes to a supermarket.
First handler of berries shall collect the assessment. First handler of strawberries. So handler, yeah, so, yeah, right. So at first point of sale, that's
all
what it
right.
says. First
let's
point of sale.
Let's look at that, if you don't mind, Commissioner, mm-hmm. and maybe see if there's a way to structure that. I mean, look, I think the general consensus is we need more money in that fund to make sure that people know what they're buying, that
yes.
they're buying something.
That's why we've leveraged it
absolutely.
In all these years.
Yeah,
you
and
know?
So.
And it is a very small assessment.
Right. I'd like to work with you on making
Please.
Sure that we have the
Can
availability.
Make a note of that, Todd?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
So that 16th of a penny or 6th of a penny, what does that generate?
Between $24,000 and $35,000 a year, I think.
Okay. So if you went to a penny, it'd take you to $100,000.
That would be significant.
Okay.
Yes.
Senator Fazit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Since you were talking about forever chemicals in our water and all, and since we're forced to put a hazardous waste of fluoride into our drinking water, and it is a forever chemical,
mm-hmm.
do we see an uptick in any, or do y'all even test for fluoride in our lakes and waters and all our streams?
The only time I've tested for those type of how you say, adulterants has been after a chemical spill. So we do not routinely, I do not routinely test for it. Now, when I say we is we in the government, I think we'd have to talk to EPA and DEQ whether or not they do. But we have run a variety of tests looking for things, you know, and again, if there is an industrial spill that's going into waterways, but we also test soil. We have done soil testing looking for heavy metals and other things to see if there's any uptick in chemicals.
And you do agree that fluoride's a forever chemical?
I would have to say it is. Now, we can have the debate on whether or not we need it for our teeth. That's a separate debate.
But, you know, the whole thing is we don't know what we're consuming, and so and I know it's a forever chemical and it's going into all our streams and waters, and I think it's an important fact that that we've been putting it in over 50 years now in this state, and I just think it's important that we try to start getting a calculation on it.
And a big thing we need to start looking at real hard is the microplastic issue.
I agree
and
with that.
We've got to figure that out. And so that, and how do we, you know, that's something that we need to really start looking at and doing some research on.
Well, between the both, I think we're really poisoning our system. So thank you so much.
No, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Fazey. Mr. Commissioner, as always, it's a pleasure to have you.
Favorable passage.
And we'll see how the vote goes. I do have some cards here in support. Two green cards, one from Cindy Bishop with the Louisiana Meat Processors and the other from Mr. Joe Mapes with the Louisiana Farm Bureau. Excellent presentation, very thorough.
Shell Rivera put this together.
Outstanding job.
That's what she does, outstanding
I figured
job.
You were up all night banging this thing out on the computer, but
yes, I did the next one.
Sure. Okay.
And I spent a few days on it, so y'all get ready. If we can get it up,
and,
please.
It's
the next one.
And as soon as Senator Wheat gets back, now we have a quorum. What's the pleasure of the committee? Senator Wheat moves to report Senate Bill 349 favorably, seeing no objection. First step in recreating the Department of Agriculture is complete. One thing we do need to do is approve the minutes from the May meeting of 2025. I'll entertain a motion. Senator Alon moves to report or to adopt the minutes from our last meeting. Seeing no objection, those minutes are adopted. Now we're going to receive a state of agriculture briefing as Commissioner Strain always does to start our legislative calendar. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank
I think
you.
Y'all are working to get that on the screen, and I'm going to pass the chair to Vice Chairman Wheat.
Should say. We may need a technical assistant here.
Yep.
Because this looks different. PowerPoint? What's that?
Let's see. Where did you? Did they open it? Or you opened
it? I didn't open it. It was there. Click off.
And so, let's start it.
Yeah, here we go. Yeah, start that one. All right. So that brings us right back.
Oh, wait a minute. This is a PDF. So it should.
Okay.
Let's see.
Nope, does not want to advance. Give us a moment. So while we are trying to get this PowerPoint up, when you look at the world of agriculture, you know, we are in some challenging times. As you saw this morning, the president and Xi Jinping are delaying their meeting for another month, which caused a precipitous drop in the price of soybeans this morning. And so, you know, these are the sorts of things that we deal with, you know, on a day-to-day basis.
Well, Mr. Commissioner, before you get to talking, just remember that I'm in a position now where I've always wanted to be, in control of the length of your speech. So
I got it.
I appreciate that. Don't let us do you like Dr. Hillman did us in school, okay?
And it's an arrow. Is that what advances?
A little arrow right there.
Right. Little arrow.
See it?
Which one? That one.
That one.
All right, let's try. Okay.
Okay, here we go.
All right, so let's see if this works. I'm going to hit enter and see what happens. Hit, no? Hit arrow?
Hit right here.
Hit right there. Let's see. Wow, but, it's, but the slides are small. It doesn't put the whole slide up. Can you do that? Oh, no. Can you please do that? Here, I will get up while you get that started. You have to bear patience with us this morning. Okay. Yes, you can get the slides up. As you say, technology is incredible when it works. Right?
You know what?
When it works.
Does it, if you hit page... Okay.
Okay, can you get it to where I can advance it now?
You may just have to click the arrows down here.
Click the arrows?
Yeah.
Okay, if you can get me back to the first slide then. There you go. Oh, that's even much better. Much better.
That was y'all a bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the Boudin balls, right? Yes, and everything. So I can tell you, though, we are truly blessed in this country with the amount of food that we have. You know, as we continue to travel the world, you know, and last time I was in Rouse's supermarket, I walked in and I just took a look around. And first you're amazed, you're awed, and then you're humbled. And because you see what in other parts of the world they do not have, right? The tremendous amount of food products that are just ready right there. And as we continue to travel the world, and what we are doing in our travels is to assessing what their needs are and then to bring our exporters together. The president has asked us to travel the world to sell commodities, and we're doing our very best to do that. Whenever possible, I try to travel on the federal nickel because I like to spend that a whole lot more. We do these trade missions with the Foreign Ag Service, but we're also taking members with us to foreign countries. And we just returned from Abidjan and Cote d'Ivoire, which is the Ivory Coast in West Africa. Todd and I were just there. And we're also with a gentleman, Dr. Bagley from Southern, to assess those needs. And we were asked there by the ambassador and the minister from Cote d'Ivoire, and specifically, and that's a country of 41 million people, but is the gateway into West Africa, which is 400 million people, and they desperately need our particular products. Okay, so I just click on this. Yes, Todd?
I think I'm going to click it.
Yeah, you go ahead. Yeah, that way I won't mess it up. So again, this is as we closed 2 days ago, and you've seen the Dow jumped up to 50, now it's at 46,000. And you can see up and down, really looking at the price of oil, what the stability is, there's a lot of money. It could jump right back up to 50. And you see that reflected, and we've had records in, the major indices. Now we start looking at the commodity prices, corn, wheat, beans, cotton. Now these went down a pretty good bit to the limits yesterday, specifically in soybeans, because of, instability and wondering what's going to happen with China right now. But again, to end of the day, what we're seeing is that overall in the world, we are now producing, we're catching up with consumption, but for a number of years we were producing less than we were consuming. But if we look at these commodity prices, they are still below production costs. That's a key figure. And I'll explain why, as inflation has went up, these commodity prices have not. And so, by and large, our farmers are struggling. Sugar is one of our bright spots because, again, this year we've had record production in tonnage and in sugar. And I would say a fair price. It could be better, but a fair price. Rice is below production. Now, cattle prices, they rose again this morning. And we have the lowest herd number since the 1960s. Lowest number of cattle since the 1960s. In spite of the highest price, and at $3.79, well, today at $3.50, those 650-pound calves, this is going into the feed, going into the feedlot. You're looking at $2,400, $2,500, $2,600 for an animal before it's fed out in the feedlot. These are record numbers. And then lumber, that is directly tied to the interest rate, and oil. Oil today, a few minutes ago, was 102.1 a barrel. It did get up to 110. It backed up into the 90s. But again, this has directly to do with the situation. Next, please. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Morning. So this is the 2024 progress report, and you can see, if you look at overall the animal commodities, about $3.1 billion. And if you look at aquaculture, and it continues to, and on hunting, $1.3 billion. And if you look at forestry, $3.5 billion. And, of course, at our overall commodities, again, 8.4, so about $13 billion. Now, this is directly to the farm. This is the farm level. And again, if you start looking at sugarcane, look at that, $1.6 billion, right? And that'll be better this year. So this is, we are an agricultural state, and we are very blessed with our diversity as well. And we are the largest state. You know, we're number one in sugar, number one in the United States for cane sugar. We're currently number three. This year, we'll probably be number two in rice. We are, again, if you look at aquaculture, we're the number one in aquaculture. And then to that aquaculture, you also got to add oysters. We have 250,000 acres of oysters, which is aquaculture, 360,000 acres of crawfish. Next slide. One of the interesting things I did learn on my last trip abroad was that throughout Africa, they catch wild crawfish. Then they use rice, and they buy a lot of rice from the United States. They dry the crawfish, and when they cook the rice, they put crawfish powder on top of the rice as a protein source. It's one of the main protein sources. And so I was watching where they were preparing a meal, and of course this was by video, but in a rural area of Western Africa where they were using McGovern Dole food, which was Louisiana rice, they had a stainless steel container, and this was for the school children, and they were cooking it over a wood fire, their fortified rice, and that is the big meal of the day. And timber, again, at 3.5 million. Pine plantations. So on our last trip into to England and to York, you know, we were there really to try to facilitate the British government and the British Net Zero Commission. They have a commission on that, that this is renewable, infinitely renewable plantations. And that's a hard concept for the EU to understand. They think every pine tree came from Sherwood Forest and Robin Hood was standing behind it at some point in time. And so I explained it to them this way. I said, do y'all drink tea? They said, yes, of course, we're in England. I said, okay, you put sugar in tea? Yes, three lumps. I said, okay, how do you think sugar's grown? Well, we don't know. I said, yeah, it's a five-year crop. We cut our timber, the first cutting at 12, and we're done by 20. It's the same sort of thing, infinitely renewable. And 80% of the timber in Louisiana is in over 10,000 private landowners. Less than 10% is government-owned, and, of course, we manage the Alexander State Forest. 10% is in a large landholders. Next, please. And sugar. And again, we've been raising cane, as we say, over 200 years. Started in New Orleans in the front of St. Louis Cathedral by the Jesuits. And it was the purpose was to make medicinal rum. As you can imagine that. And so, again, $1.6 billion in value. And, again, the largest is in St. Mary Parish. And for many parishes, this is the economy. Next. Okay. Try it. Poultry, $1.8 billion. And it is a huge part. It's not as prevalent here in South Louisiana, but it is a really big through Central and North Louisiana, over 1,000 commercial producers, over 100 million chickens on the ground any given day. And what is poultry? Value-added agriculture. That is the big deal. Corn and beans. Majority of the corn we produce here goes into these poultry. Most of our soybeans are exported, but we are working to where we can further use our own soybeans in the poultry production. Next. And again, crawfish season, you're all well aware of this. And this is, again, we've not been able to get our H-2B workers. Crawfish is 360,000 acres of farm crawfish, about 8 or 9% of the total crawfish. In addition to that comes from the wild. But these peelers are absolutely necessary for the profitability of the crawfish industry and the rice industry. The difference between shrimp and crawfish is that our crawfish is more vertically integrated. So you have the rice farmer, And then you again, then they own, they harvest the crawfish. They either use a commingled peeling operation or they have their own peeling operations. Adds to the profitability of the overall, you know, rice crawfish rotation. Arkansas, which will produce 30 to 50% less rice this year, solely relies on rice, and because of the low rice price, they may not replant. I'm concerned that this will affect our rice industry as well. Next. And so, again, you can see that empty warehouse. Next. And again, you can see on the 19th of February, following a letter that was sent by our congressional delegation, I also sent a copy to Homeland Security, Department of Labor, outlining the particular problem and what, you know, we need to go ahead and immediately get these workers in. And then I sent copies, go ahead to the next, to the USDA and to the White House as well. So pretty big things going on with FIFRA. Supreme Court is probably going to hear the case on FIFRA and Proposition 12. In the new farm bill, there's language that reiterates federal preemption on the way livestock and poultry are raised in the United States or agricultural products, and federal preemption under FIFRA for pesticides. That is always the case. And we, you know, we feel that the courts in California have erred in their decisions. But this is a big deal because always, you know, we here administer the laws for utilization of restricted use chemicals based on what's on that label. And that label is the law of the land. Next. So, again, the committee has approved language. And, again, dealing with specifically with FIFRA and Proposition 12. So, again, and the new farm bill would reiterate that the federal law, FIFRA law, is the law, and that states cannot, you know, have additional requirements not enabled under FIFRA. So that is a big deal. The farm bill has gotten out of committee and now moves to the floor. This, and as you recall, we do not have a single entity farm bill in play, and hopefully we can get a single entity farm bill in play. Next. And again, continue. If you will, let you go ahead. All right, Todd. Todd got off the arrow.
Got off the arrow. So here we go.
All right, so, again, you're talking, you know, about wildfires. We've had a record number of wildfires, and we are the main firefighters in the state. Next. And, of course, this is what it looks like when it gets out of hand. And when it's very, very dry, when you see these fires, you can tell that's not just the brush burning. It gets hot enough to where the chemicals in the trees vaporize, and then you get burning of those volatile organic hydrocarbons. And of course, we continue to, you know, to work, and again, move next, next power. So, all right, we're still not seeing the whole slides. Those were current burn bans, and we work with the local governments on their burn bans. And so you have, there you go, local government burn bans, and then you can have statewide burn bans, and then agricultural burn bans. But during the time when we had those burn bans, we still had 84 fires. Next.
So I don't know. So we have to get to
can you help us again? I think we hit the wrong key. On February 22nd was a record day for wildfires. It was about several weeks after that we had the very cold weather. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and this, and we were able to, you know, at the right at ignition. Okay, yeah, don't go anywhere too far. Right at ignition, we had aircraft in the air that saw the ignition spot. But again, we had 35 to 45 mile an hour winds. The fire started over water, so it wasn't on dry ground, and it jumped the interstate. And so on the north side, the interstate was about 300 acres. About 100 or so acres on the south side, and we were able to get that fire stopped as it was headed to the subdivisions in Lacombe. This was an arson case as well. But on that particular day, we had a record number of fires. So in 2023, we had 1,332 fires. 62,000 acres. We had 750 fires in 6 weeks. That was a very difficult time. And at one point, we had 1,000 firefighters on the fire lines from all across the United States, the National Guard, local fire departments, our fire departments, and our agencies. 2024, 595 fires, average fire burn about 9.82. We try to keep these fires at 8 to 9 acres. 2025, 732. 2026, so far, 335 fires already. A 10-year average is 752, about 16.24 acres. Sometimes when you get these big fires, if you look at, you know, the 2023, it kicks it up to that 46.55. 2023 was a record year. We held it to 62,000 acres in 1942. A million acres burned. In 1924, 5 million acres burned. Next. So, again, looking at that first few weeks, it has been very, very active. Okay, go ahead. So, enforcement, 2025, and this is our timber enforcement officers, 46 investigations, 34 closed. And, again, arrests for equipment. But we are, again, actively investigating timber theft, arson, and equipment destruction. And so, again, we're very vigilant, especially dealing with arson. Next. And we have two heavy equipment academies. Those are held at the Woodworth Complex, where they train on this equipment, on these bulldozers, and they have to complete RT-130, which is a high-level training, National Wildlife, Wildfire, I'm sorry, coordination, and we have CDL driver courses. We also work with our rural volunteer fire departments with volunteer firefighter assistance grants. These are all federally funded, where we help them with directly with money and with equipment. Next. So again, this is what those the new units look like. That is a John Deere 650, and those are on some new trucks, Western Star. That truck has to be built specifically for that unit. Those dozers are specifically built. Now, of the 22 new ones that we put into service, we've already had two failures of those new units. One was in that fire there in Covington, and so that engine, you know, for whatever reason, the engine blew, and another one was an intake issue for air intake. But we're working with John Deere to figure out what's going on. We will be asking for 25 more dozers. Most of the equipment was bought. We're replacing the 2002 with these units. We have 2007, so most of the other dozers were all bought in 2007. And so when they're out there, they're under intense pressure, you know, and again, failure of these units could mean the loss of life for that operator. And that is a big deal. And so, again, when they have to go, they have to go. And you can see how these things are specialty built to go in and, again, into the fires. And those are some of those new units that came in. Next. So, again, 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Only you can prevent wildfires. Next. Okay. And so, speaking with Lee Zeldin, again, talking about gypsum, and thank you for passing that as a way to help reduce our cost of utilization of gypsum that is produced as a byproduct. Across the world, they allow the use of gypsum that has up to 34 picocuries per gram of radium. Here, we're limited to 10. So Brazil can use up to 34, then grow soybeans and send them here, but we can't use it here. That needs to be raised. Our average is about 14. This degree of radiation, that vaporizes within 2 weeks if you put it on the field. It's about the same as you have in concrete. Next. And then we pass rules for utilization of that gypsum. All right, so the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program, that is in play, and there's $11 billion, and it's being distributed. Next. That is to help the farmers, again, to get them to the bridge to where, again, they can make new loans. Sugar is going to get $150 million. We will administer that through the Agriculture Finance Authority. So overall, if you look at crop prices, you go back to, you know, what is happening? Why are we in this mess? Look at the crop prices in 2022 and look at now. And I want you to think about what inflation has been since 2022 to now. Okay, go ahead. So row crop losses on every acre. Next. And then, again, if you look at these are the payments of the bridge program to assist. Go to the next slide. So if you look at the payments versus the loss, the corn payments are $44.36 an acre, but the net loss is $169. Rice, $132 versus $154 in loss. And so this is to help bridge the gap, but it is not filling the gap completely. And what happened in the first year, there were losses. The farmers were able to take that losses and put them on the end of the long-term notes and refinance. USDA had special refinancing rates as well. Second year, they were allowed to take anticipated government payments and put on the balance sheet as receivables. This year, the bank said, we got to have some money. Next. So again, if you look at the price indices, the price received versus the price for farmers, you can see that divergence, and it's still there. Next. And then if you look at the average cost for production for next year, it's still slightly higher than this year, and we have those record prices, even though we're only anticipating, again, a mild increase in the value of those commodities. Next. Production costs continue to rise, and it's one of the things I was with Undersecretary Vaden, Judge Vaden, a couple of weeks ago, and they're really taking a hard, hard look at cost as well, and how do we mitigate that cost? And so that's why looking at such things as using the gypsum we have here for the sulfur and using other methodologies to decrease and hold our costs down. Next. Farm bill enhancements, those kick in October. That will help. They are raising the payment baselines for the crop insurance. That is a big deal, but that will kick in October. Next. All right, there's also disaster assistance from the impacted from the winter storms, but most of that is through the National Resource Conservation Service dealing with a number of programs. There's the Livestock Indemnity Program as well through the FSA. Next. But also the ELAP program, Emergency Assistance for Livestock and Honeybees and other things, so the farmers can directly apply for that. Now, let's get to the meat of why we have a problem. If you look at the last, going back to 2012, look at the value, devaluation of currency. So the euro was up to about $1.46, and now you see it at $1.16. So what that means is it is more difficult for us to sell our commodities abroad because we sell in dollars, but we import based on foreign currencies. Okay, next. Pound sterling. A pound sterling got up to about almost $1.70. Now it's $1.34. Next. Look at the Japanese money. Look at the precipitous and continued devaluation of Japanese money. And then next. And then the Chinese dollar. Okay, now let's go to the next one. All right. So if you talk about the seafood industry, you know, why they're importing, you know, yes, please.
Before the group leaves, if you want to introduce yourself right quick, Commissioner Strain, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
If somebody wants to come and introduce the group to us.
Yes, please. Someone come to the mic. We need a volunteer. You look good. Come on. Please, whoever it is. And tell us your name and who you are.
Hello, sir. I'm Preston Hughes, and we're from Bossier City. We're our Bossier City Leadership Group here to come listen to y'all.
Well, thank you all very much for being at the Capitol. I think you got to sit in on one of our committees of one of the hardest working departments in the state of Louisiana. So you get to hear a little bit about where our food and where our natural resources are protected. So thank you all for being here today.
Yes, sir. It was a true honor. Thank you.
You don't want to continue the PowerPoint?
Oh, yes, sir. If I knew it, yes, sir.
Thank you,
yes,
sir.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Sir. Thank you,
Senator Bass would be here today.
He was. He's probably in another committee.
Yeah, Senator Bass got three bills in three different committees, so he had to step out, yes. Okay. I'll tell him you asked for him.
Thank you.
Okay. Get that back up. There you go. All right, so when we were talking about the dumping of shrimp and rice, and you saw today the information about, you know, in our people telling the United States government, do not allow the Indian government to dump rice. But they're also, when you're talking about why did we have a 50% tariff and an 8% anti-dumping duties on Indian shrimp. So look at the devaluation. That's 50% devaluation of their currency. So that means it cut the price of an import in half. So by putting 58% tariffs, you don't even get it back to the break even. Okay? So they said, well, how can they produce a product in India cheaper than we can produce it in the United States? But it looks at the overall valuation of their currency. And also the Indian, when you look at their rice production and their farms, the average farm in India is 2.6 hectares. So about less than 6 acres. And it's hand production, okay? So this is a big deal. All right, so there's a lot of information on these slides, but we're going to focus on just a couple of things. If you look at the projection of March total output of total grains, 2,976 million metric tons. Total consumption.